Who is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor, or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive orders.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the basics that you may have forgotten or slept through in school. With more than 500 members of Congress, parties have to coordinate to keep the rank and file in line, which brings us to a political position you've probably heard of but may not know so much about. And that is the subject of today's lesson.
Hi, this is Mark calling from Houston, Texas, the Bayou City. I was wondering, what is a majority or minority whip? What do they do, and how are they selected? Thanks, y'all.
Quick note before we jump off in today's lesson. We taped this on the morning of June 14. Now, this was just before receiving the news that House Majority Whip Steve Scalise and others had been shot at a practice for an annual congressional baseball game. It is a tragedy that reminds us, behind the abstract civics lessons about jobs and duties and protocols, there are real people with real families and real lives making real sacrifices. And yet the aim of this podcast is to better understand the structure of democracy. So we decided to go ahead and take this important opportunity to learn about what party whips like Steve Scalise actually do. Larry Evans is a government professor at the College of William and Mary and with us to talk about the role of the whip. Hello, Larry.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Ready to crack this thing? I mean, I couldn't resist.
Absolutely. The whip topic does sort of call to mind lots of metaphors.
What is the role of a party whip?
Well, both chambers, both parties have whips, and they fulfill a bunch of related tasks, largely having to do with the building of coalitions within the party on the floor before roll call votes that are really important to the party agenda.
So it is a noun, but also a verb. I hear about whipping. What does a whip do to whip votes?
Well, you can think about it in terms of stages. The first stage would be the crafting of the question and essentially the decision about whether or not to whip a vote or not. That's an important decision. There are a lot of major votes and issues that don't get whipped on Capitol Hill because there are divisions within the relevant party and it's not important to the agenda. So that's kind of the first stage is deciding to engage and then deciding where in the process to engage, what question to ask, which juncture to essentially try and exert the pressure.
And when you say which question or juncture, that is forming a bill or a proposal?
Oh, actually, the whips often will do their work fairly early on. So in the early 2000s, for instance, on a major trade bill back in 2001-2002, Tom DeLay, actually the House Republican whip from 1995 to 2002, and by any measure was the most successful whip in congressional history, whipped a subset of his members at the very beginning of that Congress before there was even legislation to get a sense of what the lay of the land was, and that helped them then draft the bill that might be passable. So that sometimes happens, but I was actually referring more to do you whip an amendment? Do you whip a procedural vote? Do you whip final passage? What you want to do is find that juncture in the floor decision-making process where the party coalition may be weakest and most frayed, and then you want to sort of push back. Stage two basically is the actual initial count, where the assistants and the deputies will fan out and talk to members either directly or through staff to get a sense of what their initial leanings are. That then gets reported back to the party leadership, and it's tabulated. So that's stage two. Stage three, then, is to gauge the likelihood that the party will carry the day on the floor. And in the majority, what that often involves is then making some changes in the underlying text or working some deals that will put them over the top. So there's this kind of combined lobbying sort of legislative compromise process that occurs after stage two.
So their work has mostly been done before anything even hits the floor.
If the whip operation is effective, when they bring that bill to the floor, they should have a pretty good idea what the outcome is. Now, that being said, on both parties, the whips will be there on the floor during major votes. They'll be stationed at strategic spots throughout the House, at the doorways and the well of the House over by the cloakroom. And they know, basically, which members are potential no or leaning no or undecided members. And they'll basically touch base with them and try to make sure they stay with the party. So the whipping actually occurs right up until the vote. And at times, it's actually right till the end of the vote. There were many instances in the 1990s and 2000s, for instance, when DeLay, who I've mentioned, was whipped for the Republicans, where he would be within about five or six votes. And so what he would do is he'd have maybe five or 10 Republicans sitting in the well of the House in the first row. And then they'd wait and they'd look up at the board on the wall that keeps track of the votes. And he'd figure out exactly how many votes he needed to prevail. And he'd, if let's say he needed three votes, he'd go, you, you, and you, you're going to vote yes. And everybody else is, you know, free to vote however they want. So it's actually beginning to the end.
You mentioned that not every vote gets whipped. So in a case of something that, like, say, the number of times that the House Republicans during the Obama administration tried to pass or tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they probably wouldn't need to whip that because it's not going to be a close vote. They know how it's going to land.
Absolutely. Now, my guess is the first time they repealed or attempted to repeal Obamacare, probably close to 50 times, maybe the first couple of times, they counted heads just to make sure that everybody was together. But after that, it was almost it was a done deal. They knew they'd have complete loyalty. They don't whip, for instance, the most partisan vote of the Congress is a selection of the speaker. And that's almost always strictly along party lines. And that vote is seldom whipped. If it is whipped, it's because of a special circumstance. For instance, Gingrich back in the 90s, when he was reelected as speaker one year, they whipped that vote because he was under an ethics cloud and they were afraid they'd lose some Republican votes.
Have you ever watched House of Cards?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Frank Underwood in the first, maybe second season, he was the House Majority Whip?
He was the House Majority Whip, that's
and,
right.
And how accurate is that depiction, that role of Frank Underwood, kind of working rooms and working the phones to get votes in his favor?
Absolutely. Well, that part was accurate. The tactics that he used to gain votes.
You mean like pushing people into oncoming trains, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's not a standard approach. Typically, whips will know the districts of the members that they need to persuade, and they'll try to frame the issue in a way that is persuadable to them. They'll also use internal patronage, committee assignments, party campaign money, and the like. They'll often enlist important constituents back in the district to also, you know, influence the member, but they don't generally throw people in front of trains or engage in other sort of felonious activity.
How is a whip chosen?
The top party positions, the top whips now, are elected by their fellow partisans in the relevant chamber. The Republicans have pretty much always done it that way. The Democrats in the House, interestingly enough, it was the majority leader who would choose the whip until 1986, at which point they changed the rules to let rank-and-file Democrats make that choice. The rest of the party organization, the rest of the whips, though, are generally appointed by whoever the whip is. And so House Republicans, the whip right now, Mr. Scalise, appointed a fairly large network of assistants. For the Democrats, the main counters, they've got the Democrats divide the country up into zones, and each zone has two assistant whips who do the lion's share of the actual counting. They are actually elected by the members of their relevant geographic zone. Whereas the other whips for the Democrats, there are a bunch of other people involved in the process who do a lot of the lobbying and the persuasion. They're appointed by the top leadership.
Why would somebody want to take this position on? Is it a position of power?
Well, I don't know if it's power. There's some power because you're in the middle of the most important votes in coalition building that occurs on Capitol Hill. So you get access to all kinds of information. There's a lot of trading back and forth and reciprocity. So you do build up some political capital. It's also a stepping stone to higher positions in the leadership, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle. People often would move up from whip to majority leader to speaker if the party was in the majority. And many members just enjoy being consequential and about playing a very visible and important role. That makes a difference to them, and that's a benefit that they get in and of itself.
You've pointed out some differences between how the different parties treat or appoint or listen to their whips from the sounds of it. Why do you think that evolved differently within the respective parties?
Well, there are some subtle differences. And, you know, the fact that the House Republican whip system and leadership more generally is more top-down driven than is the case on the Democratic side of the aisle, I do think is one likely reason is that the Republicans historically have been more homogeneous in the kinds of districts that they represent. So different members, rank and file members of the Republican conference, probably come from districts in their demographic makeup, which are actually pretty similar. There's a lot more heterogeneity at the constituency level on the Democratic side of the aisle. And so the Democrats, you know, I think have had to focus more on building coalitions from the bottom up rather than saying, you know, this is the party position and here are your marching orders.
But if the coalitions are strong within a party, does the whip really matter? I mean, don't those coalitions, those influencing agents inside of the parties actually do the work?
Well, that's true. So if you're doing a whip count, let's say you've got a majority party with 230 members, which is on sort of the somewhat small size, but still, you know, a reasonable majority. When you do a whip count on a party vote, you're probably going to have between 180 and maybe 200 members answering yes, absolutely, and with the leadership. But you're still going to have about 20 to 30 who are undecided or leaning no. So you're always going to be, you're generally going to be just a tad short of where you need to be as a majority party to prevail. And that's where the whips step in. They sort of make the difference on the margin, and those margins really matter on close votes.
What's the whip's relationship with the Speaker of the House?
Well, it varies depending a bit on sort of personality and the internal politics of the leadership. Generally speaking, the whip is expected to be a loyal lieutenant. Decisions about which issues, for instance, are going to be whipped are typically made by the Speaker and the Majority Leader together or the Minority Leader on the minority side of the aisle. So the whip is expected to work with the leadership. But there have been times where the supporting coalition for the whip has been different than the supporting coalition for the Speaker. So, for instance, back in the 1990s, Tom DeLay was whip. Newt Gingrich was Speaker. DeLay, I think, by any measure, probably the most effective whip in congressional history, was very closely tied in to strongly conservative members of the Republican conference. Gingrich somewhat less so, and there was a split. And DeLay was actually part of an attempt, a coup attempt, to take Gingrich out as Speaker. So occasionally there are differences that break out.
Any other notable whips passed?
Oh, sure. For the Republicans in the House, Trent Lott played a really significant role as the minority whip during the Reagan administration, largely in reaching across the aisle and getting Democratic votes for Reagan priorities. Tony Coelho for the Democrats in the 1980s was really, really influential. It's also important to remember that there are whips on the Senate side as well. Their role is less institutionalized. The whip networks there are much smaller. But there have been some very important whips. Robert C. Byrd, one of the most important Senate Democratic leaders of the 20th century, began his role in the leadership as whip back in the 1970s. I'd also, you know, I'd mention Don Nichols of Oklahoma, who was whip during the same time period that DeLay was whip in the House, late 1990s and the early 2000s, who played a very significant role over there.
So for our Civics 101 scholars, when they hear something about a majority or minority whip, what do you think should be their takeaway? What should they understand about this role?
Well, for the majority whip, the role is to help the leadership and the majority party as a whole put together coalitions to pass legislation. And on the minority side of the aisle, particularly in the House, the role of the whip is to help fashion an opposition, in a sense, to throw tax on the road. And that often involves, you know, ensuring that as many of those minority party members as possible stay loyal to the party position and vote no.
Larry Evans, government professor at the College of William and Mary, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
That's it for today's lesson. This episode was produced by Molly Donahue and edited by Jimmy Gutierrez. If this podcast has been a valuable resource for you and you think others would benefit from learning about the fundamentals of American democracy, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly called iTunes. It's kind of like that Rate Your Professor website, and it really does help us know how we're doing and lets others know where to find us. So if you have a minute, weigh in. Music in this episode is from Broke for Free. I'm Virginia Prescott, and Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.